it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room and Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today we talk cooking and eating the vegan way, and it's not your mother's vegan cooking. Our guest is Isa Chandra Moskowitz, the award-winning author and diva of Public Access TV's Post-Punk Kitchen. David Rosengarten has the one city in India not to miss, the place where the rich and regal food of the North meets up with the zing and the zap of the foods of the South. We talk King Corn, the new film about two unsuspecting guys who decide to raise an acre of corn. The reason? Well, they want to see where it takes them. Then it's our own agricultural experiment, Locavore Nation. 15 volunteers trying to eat local, sustainable, and organic for a year. Today we talk with our first locavore. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, where's the latest trip in?
We've been going to North Carolina a lot recently, and one of the things that occurred to us when we went to a place called the Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen is that two things North Carolinians do really well are make biscuits and fry chicken. And at the Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen, you can get both in one item, which is a chicken biscuit, a patty of white meat fried chicken inside of a really good fluffy buttermilk biscuit. It is heaven.
This sounds like it dangerously borders on some very well-advertised fast food.
Oh, God, no. No, you will go to hell and
different
burn
universe.
For that. This is nothing like that thing.
No, and in fact, the biscuits are the specialty, needless to say, if the name of the place is Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen. And the fried chicken is just one thing you can get inside of your biscuit. You can also get some really great country ham, you know, the rank, salty, chewy country ham. What goes better with a fluffy buttermilky biscuit than that? I mean, it's such an extreme contrast, but they go so well together.
You know what I love about this place, other than the fabulous biscuits with whatever inside? I love that kind of 1940s sound of the name, Sunrise Biscuit Kitchen. I mean, doesn't that just sound like something out of an old little, you know, pamphlet from the 1940s of how to start your family eating correctly at breakfast?
Is the place, I mean, does the place feel like a 1940s sort of luncheonette?
Well, it's actually more 1950s in the sense that there is absolutely no place to eat here. It is strictly a drive-in restaurant. You pull up your car, you place your order, and then it's up to you to find a place to eat. I mean, there's a very small parking area adjacent to the Sunrise Kitchen where you can pull over and eat. A lot of people just take it somewhere else, but there is no indoor eating whatsoever.
And I'll tell you what my favorite thing to eat there is, and I guarantee you, you will swell up to twice your normal size.
Oh, great.
But it doesn't
Who doesn't
matter.
Want to do that?
Thanks, Jane. I needed that.
Is a country ham biscuit with a big icy cup of sweet tea.
Sweet tea.
The side.
Oh, yeah.
So you go back and forth between this, you know, wonderful glucose-like tea and the salty ham.
It's a perfect balance when you think about it.
Yeah, it's sort of like
it's a wide-spectrum meal, and it's really a good one. I mean, sweet tea, it's funny because a lot of people from the North just don't get the importance of sweet tea. But when you eat a lot of ham, fried chicken, those meat and three vegetable plates that you eat throughout the South, sweet tea is pretty much essential.
Well, you know what people don't get it around the Northeast where we live?
Uh-huh.
And this is the beginning of a rant, so I will stop
here we
myself.
Go. Ice.
Ice. It's the ice factor because when you order a beverage in the Northeast, it's room temperature, and maybe there's one little ice cube floating in it. You can't serve sweet tea unless it's in a giant glass, absolutely on top of, you know, a ton of crushed ice. I mean, it has to be ice cold.
You know, that's a very good point. I mean, that changes the entire experience. One other question, though. Where is this place?
We're not going to tell you.
Oh, all right.
It's our secret. No, it's Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a little bit out of town. Just, it's not downtown, but it's on the outskirts of Chapel Hill. So it's easy to get to if you're anywhere in that area.
I got one other question.
Yes.
I always divide fried chicken into two camps. There is the camp of light coat on the, you know, maybe flour or cornmeal or whatever on the chicken and you fry it. And then there is the more batter dipped fried chicken that gives you all those crunchies and whatever. You can gather what camp I prefer. What's the style of fried chicken at this place?
Not to say anything bad about batter fried chicken, which can be very good, but this is the thin crusted fried chicken. It's just kind of a thin envelope of luscious crust and very rich. I mean, the crust on this chicken is so rich you almost want to call it bacony. It's got that real kind of schmaltzy, chicken fatty flavor to it.
Very highly seasoned.
Highly seasoned. And that, again, pairs so well with the biscuit and the chicken meat inside.
You wouldn't want a really bready piece of chicken on a biscuit. I mean,
that's a good
you're getting
point.
Into redundancy point. There. But it's perfect. It's just absolutely perfect. Just go eat it and you'll see.
All right, now you finally told us where it was. Where it is.
We thought we could sneak it by without telling you exactly where it was.
Oh, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Len.
Goodbye, Len. How many biscuits can you eat this morning? Well, how many biscuits can you eat this morning? How many biscuits can you eat?
49 and a ham of meat this morning.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, the Sterns check in with us here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's our weekly attempt to make your midweek kitchen life a little simpler. Every week, you get a new recipe, along with shopping and technique tips. But best of all, it's free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. I call David Rosengarten the man with the golden palate. He makes his living eating, well, to be more genteel, tasting. David's lifetime goal seems to be to track down everything that tastes good anywhere in the world and then to report on it in his newsletter, The Rosengarten Report. David, welcome.
Nice to be here, Lynn, as always.
Now, David, I understand that you've been in Hyderabad. Am I pronouncing that? It's in India. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
I've heard people say that. I've also heard people say Hyderabad. So I usually just say Hyderabad.
Well, tell me about it. First of all, where is this place?
It's in the south central part of India. It's very much a southern city. It's a large city. There's something like, 15 million people there. And it's amazing that we Americans generally don't know about it, but it's larger than almost every American city. And it's not far from what's become sort of the high-tech corridor of India, not far from Bangalore, which is their Silicon Valley.
So obviously, if you've been there, there's something that sets it apart. So what's the deal with the food?
Yeah, you know, I lead trips to India because I love Indian food. Do you? Are you
on
my side?
Absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
Gosh. I think one of the most underappreciated cuisines in America. Hyderabad is the ultimate fusion place in India. It's in the south, yes, but in the 1600s, the Mughal rulers in the north of India, the ones who put up the Taj Mahal, the ones who, you know, they're basically Muslims, and they ruled India for many years. But they sort of got kicked out of the north of India in the 17th century, and they moved south, and they brought their food with them. And they established this great tradition of empire in Hyderabad. The rulers there became known as Nizams. So the Nizams developed this incredibly complex fusion cuisine that had all this royal courtliness about it, but it brought the kind of rich creaminess and meatiness from the north, you know, and many of the foods that we think of as Indian food is actually northern Indian food, or what we say today, Punjabi food.
Right.
Chicken tandoori and creamy, you know, kormas and things like that. That's butter, milk, cream, meat. That's all very northern. In the south, the food is generally lighter, spicier. Hyderabad is in the state of Andhra Pradesh, which is the place where you get the hottest chilies in India. In the South, they also like sour things very much, souring agents. So there's a lot of lemon, tamarind, yogurt, something called amchur powder, which is a powder made from dried mangoes. And it's a combination of that southern, you know, liveliness
right.
with the northern heaviness that makes really some of the most delicious food in India.
So can you give me some example? What kind of dishes are we talking about?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that, you know, is amazing there is biryani, which is the northern rice dish cooked with spices. And very typically in the north, they'll cook it in a sealed pot for a long time and then break the seal at dinner time. There's a very particular Hyderabadi style of biryani in which they combine souring agents and lots of spices with it. And so it's the liveliest, you know, Indian rice casserole that you've ever had. But perhaps even more importantly, I think of Hyderabad as kebab central. All that grilling that goes on in the, or the roasting really, or the baking that goes on in the tandoor in the north of India happens in Hyderabad, but not really in the tandoor, more on an open grill. And the spicing, Lynn, on this stuff, I mean, in the north, it's relatively mellow.
Right.
In Hyderabad, it is like, wow, your mouth just explodes with every bite of these things. There's a restaurant in, there's a town right next to Hyderabad. It's like a sister city.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a restaurant there called Paradise. And that's a pretty good description. I mean, this place turns out a ton, literally, the owner told me, a ton of biryani every day. He's now like this huge institution and he caters all over the bi-city area. But the grilled things that I had there, like, I remember chicken kebabs that were heavily flavored with garlic. I remember lamb kebabs that were, after the grilling, they were rolled in a combination of green herbs like mint and cilantro and things like that. They were so incredibly lively. And one thing that I had there that really flipped me out was, you know, paneer, the firm Indian cheese.
Yeah,
I had a saffron-gilded paneer kebab with the incredible southern spices and chili heat and also threaded on the skewer with green pepper.
They actually threaded the cheese on a kebab and it didn't melt away. It just stayed. That sounds unbelievable.
It was so good. And you're right. That's exactly the issue. Does it melt or not? But they've chosen just the right paneer. So it gets all kind of, you know, grilled and brown and marked on the outside. And it's creamy and starting to fall apart, but just on the inside. So it just explodes in your mouth with this ooze.
Savory marshmallow.
Yes, exactly. S'mores.
Hey, David, thank you.
It is my pleasure.
David Rosengarten is creator and author of the newsletter, The Rosengarten Report. Now, if you can't get on a plane this weekend, you should treat yourself anyway to a forage in an Indian market. Now, it's not that you have to cook all Indian food, but there is so much great shortcut stock on those shelves. For instance, flavoring pastes, from curry paste to chutneys. And these are great as marinades, bastes, pan sauces, dips. Then there's the frozen flatbreads, and they come spiced or maybe not spiced, but they're great for hors d'oeuvre, for wrapping anything, for dipping. Now, India is the legume capital of the world. More kinds of dried peas, lentils, and beans are in those shops than you can dream of. Just cook some up with some of that curry paste, and you've got an instant supper. And the spices? Buy a little of anything that's new to you. Then use the Indian technique of lightly toasting the spices in a skillet to release their scents and their flavors. Now, once you sniff, you'll get all kinds of ideas of how to use each one. Look, I'm going on and on here. There's a book that's pure gold for this kind of shopping. It's called The Indian Grocery Store Demystified, and it's by Linda Bladholm. Okay, coming up, vegan as a lusty alternative and America as one nation under corn. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed to last for years to come. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in the home at roomandboard.com. I think our food preferences go a lot deeper than we know. I think they're part of the bedrock of our personal identity. We tend to look at different eating philosophies, as in ones that are not ours, as being from another planet. For instance, they eat rare meat. We don't. They eat bugs. We don't. They eat in a way that we would never eat. Well, I think veganism falls into this category. To a lot of omnivores, it seems pretty foreign. Well, there's a book that could change that perception. The recipes stand on their own as just good eating. And it's by two award-winning authors who also hosted the public access TV cooking show, The Post-Punk Kitchen. The book is Veganomicon, The Ultimate Vegan Cookbook. Its co-author, Issa Chandra Moskowitz, joins us. Issa, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Issa, what is your food about?
Well, it's about cooking without any animal products and just having great food.
Whenever anybody hears the word vegan, I think they think, okay, there's no animal products. And the big question always is the same. How do you get protein?
Right. I think people put a lot too much weight on where you get your protein from. There's so many different places to get it. We get it from grains, from legumes, from vegetables. There's protein everywhere. And we don't need that much. I think it's something like 50 to 70 something grams a day, depending on your weight and if you're a male or female.
Are soy foods a big part of the diet usually?
They are if you want them to be. It's not, veganism isn't the kind of thing where this is what you eat. It's like, you know, we have a whole plant kingdom to choose from. So if you want to eat soy products, if you like them, if you like tofu and tempeh, then go for it. Otherwise, there's plenty of vegans that don't eat soy at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think for a long time, people were just trying to figure out how to substitute things. Like, how do I... That's the market is crowded with all these meat substitutes. And that's cool. That got me through my teenage years of veganism. I think just stop thinking, how am I going to substitute this? And just start thinking, you know, what can I have that's already vegan? And getting creative with beans and grains and things like that.
It's interesting, this idea that we tend to really separate ourselves by how we eat or how we see other people eat. And, you know, America was built on that idea that, well, if you had meat, we were strong, you know, and we were wealthy and all of that.
Right.
So there must be an awful lot of backlash when you kind of let the world know you're a vegan. Do you face
that? Yeah, there
that?
Is. Well, America was built on a lot of ideals that I don't necessarily agree with, so there's that. But people do tend to get defensive when you say, I don't eat meat, because right away it's an accusation whether or not you like it and whether or not you mean to sound judgmental. It's saying, I'm doing something. It's saying, I think I eat better than you do. On the other hand, all ways of eating are an ideology. You can't just say veganism is an ideology. Eating meat is an ideology as well.
You know, I think people would really like to eat this way, but they see it as being really hard. How would you suggest you get going in it?
I think getting a vegan cookbook. It doesn't have to be mine. You know, go on the internet, look at the... There's vegetarian starter kits everywhere. Vegan Outreach has a great one. And then just looking at recipes and looking at food blogs and getting excited about that. A lot of times people are already educated about factory farming and meat eating and the environmental problems with it. And so if you're at that point and now you just want to know how, then start with the food.
So, Issa, what should I have in the pantry, for instance?
I think your pantry items would be pretty similar to pantry items as an omnivore. So you just have, and it also depends what you like. Basically, I always have garlic, onions, balsamic vinegar, olive oil, grapeseed oil, every spice under the sun. As far as like dry goods, I myself always have several types of grains. So I have quinoa, different kinds of rice, polenta. I have every type of dried bean you can imagine, and also canned beans. So lots of chickpeas for me. But it really depends on what you like eating, because obviously if you don't like chickpeas, don't have chickpeas. Have black beans, pinto beans, white beans. I use white beans a ton. There's things also that I use that other, you know, like capers and olives, which I
Yeah, you have a real Mediterranean streak in this book.
Yeah, there is.
I love it.
Which was cool because the last book was all curries. So we were like, all right, let's chill on the curries a little bit. There's enough vegan curries in the world.
The interesting, too, because you talk about grains, and I think that's maybe an area a lot of us aren't familiar with. And when you talk about quinoa and, you know, I'm just thinking about what's out there that we just don't deal with, like, well, buckwheat.
Right. Well, also, everything is so versatile. Like, quinoa doesn't have to just be a bowl of mush. We mm-hmm. use it in croquettes, and we use it in casseroles, and we just really explore everything you can do with it. And the same thing with beans and transforming them from just a side dish into a main dish. We make cutlets out of chickpeas. We blend beans and nuts and make quiches.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, it is. And it's really fun, too. It's a whole new territory. And often I think, well, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just have to work with all the knowledge we have. We should be able to come up with lots of diverse, delicious dishes.
Yeah. Hey, Issa, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Issa Chandra Moskowitz is co-author of Veganomicon, the ultimate vegan cookbook. Now, Issa left us with a recipe that she sees as a jumping-off place for all kinds of dishes. You can find asparagus quiche with tomatoes and tarragon on a website, splendidtable.org. There is this story. Two friends graduate from college, and instead of going after the big jobs, they decide to take a year and grow an acre of corn. And no, they are not in an ag program. They're city kids from Boston. Director and producer Aaron Wolf decided to film the experience. Well, the result is the documentary feature film, King Corn. Aaron Wolf is with us. Aaron, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
So what got, it's Ian Chaney and Kurt Ellis, what got them to the point where they decided to grow an acre of corn?
Well, in the manner of full disclosure, I'll tell you that Kurt Ellis is my cousin, and Ian Chaney is his best friend. And when we began this program, they knew nothing about making films, and I knew very little about food. And they had taken a concern in the subject of food, in part because they had read that for the first time in American history, their generation might be the first that had a shorter life expectancy than the previous.
Huh.
And it had to do with what they ate.
At one point in the beginning of the film, they actually have their hair tested because evidently our hair is a gauge of what we've been eating, right?
Yeah, hair, incredibly, is like a tape recorder, a running tape recorder of what we eat.
And what did they find?
Well, they find that even though they thought they had a varied diet of hamburgers and french fries and sodas and donuts and all sorts of things that college kids eat,
right,
what they'd actually been eating is some kind of a transmutation of corn.
So almost all of those things were based in corn?
Almost all of those things were in some way or another a transformation of corn, whether it was high fructose corn syrup in the sodas or corn-fed beef in the hamburgers
mm-hmm.
or corn oil in the french fries. A lot of what we as Americans eat turns out to come from corn.
So this leads them to go to Iowa and essentially rent an acre of land from a corn farmer.
Yeah, you know, it's this kind of participatory journalism where you really go back and try to trace the origins of things and see what happens. And I think for all of us it was maybe more naive than it might seem.
Mm-hmm.
We really thought that, you know, the food system, which has become so opaque in so many ways, would almost immediately become clear to us if we could just get back to this kind of imaginary root of the system. And in the case of American food, that root is a cornfield in Iowa.
And that wasn't the case.
No. You know, I think one of the things that immediately provided a kind of a solidarity between us as consumers and the farmers we met there, who are the producers, is that neither one of us really knew, you know, we knew as little about where our food came from as they knew about where their food went.
Hmm.
And there was this kind of solidarity that we both shared in this opaque food system that we were both confronting from opposite sides.
And so what you're actually saying is that all of that corn that's produced is going into products that end up on the food shelves, but not necessarily in ways that are obvious.
Yeah, you know, we talk about naive. I mean, we didn't know that there was any difference between the sweet corn that we eat Fourth of July picnics and is a wonderful and marvelous food source,
right?
Not to mention delicious, was any different from the 90 million or so acres that Americans plant in this other kind of corn called field corn? I guess if you, you know, if you grew up in the Midwest, you know that.
Yeah.
But we didn't. And we didn't know that all those soybean fields out there weren't edamame.
So these are all grains that are really meant for commercial use. They're not necessarily
sweet. They're really
sweet
an industrial product. I mean, I think Michael Pollan has expressed it as well as anyone that what we're growing out there is kind of a feedstock for industrial processes and not really quite something that we imagine as food.
One of the things in the film that I was rather struck by was the men trace the corn to corn-fed beef.
Yeah.
And to the feedlots, which have been highly criticized, that the ranchers who ran these feedlots or raised those animals, their frustration with what happens to an animal when it's raised on corn, and you sensed in listening to them, they almost felt trapped by a system where this is the only way they could make a living.
I think that was one of the biggest surprises. You know, none of us are really political radicals, and, you know, this came out of a very real and very solid inquiry to kind of know where our food came from. Mm-hmm. And it didn't come out of a kind of a, you know, a rabble-rousing urge to kind of stir things up. And I think that, as you point out, one of the things that really surprised us was that many farmers who would seem to be kind of the stalwarts of the system really were having their own frustrations. Corn farmers, you know, one farmer in the film describes that what they're growing was crap.
Yeah.
And that just came out of nowhere during that interview, and it was really, really shocking to us. And, yes, I think there are many cattle ranchers that really lament that, you know, ranching has a heroic past in the American imagination, out on the range, you know, these fields of pasture and cattle and our kind of our cowboy ethos. It's a far cry from a feedlot with 100,000 head of cattle jammed in together, being almost force-fed on starchy grain.
That grain makes them ill, the ranchers said.
Yeah,
makes the cows ill.
We're essentially feeding them fast food. And it's telling that to make our fast food, which is, you know, thought to be a component in the American obesity crisis, we're essentially making these cattle obese first.
Aaron, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Aaron Wolf is director and producer of the feature documentary film King Corn. Making the film moved Aaron to open his own grocery store exclusively for local products. It's called Urban Rustic. Well, for more information, you can go to the website, splendidtable.org. I've been fascinated to see how our food attitudes are shifting. Not too long ago, you'd serve up maybe fresh peaches for a winter dessert in, let's say, Idaho, and folks might coo with pleasure. You do the same thing today, and your pals are going to demand to know its carbon footprint, the politics of the farmer, the rights of the pickers, and even if it's organic. Well, we learned this firsthand when we asked you to take part in our sustainability survey. Now, in it, we asked for volunteers to commit to eating mainly local foods that are organic and seasonal for an entire year. 5,000 volunteered. Eventually, 15 people were chosen from across the country to participate in the project that we're calling Locavore Nation. So over the next year, we're going to be talking with each of the participants to hear how things are going, and we're all going to be blogging on the website. Laura Solorio, our first locavore, is on the line. Laura, welcome.
Hi.
Laura, this is, you know, a really demanding challenge. Why are you taking the time to do it?
Well, I've been interested in food, I think, since I was a kid. You know, my mom always had home-cooked meals. I always wanted to know why we couldn't have Hamburger Helper, you know, things like that. And, you know, she just always cooked our meals, and so I was the one daughter who really loved cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because I live in Salinas, California, and I grew up in Hollister, California, food was just always available. Local produce, local fruit. I cut apricots every summer of my life until I went to college. Uh-huh. So I've always had a lot of fresh ingredients around. And then, you know, I'm a big fan of Barbara Kingsolver, and I read her book,
right.
And, you know, I listened to your show, and I like reading about food. And so as time went on, I sort of dropped the bananas and started thinking about, you know, where my food came from. And like I said, it's not that hard for me to get good local food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to come back to that issue, but first, tell us a little bit about your life.
Well, I work full time.
What do you do?
I'm a physician. I'm an internist, and I work in a community health center, and most of, probably over 60% of my patients have diabetes, so mm-hmm. we talk about food a lot.
Right.
And a lot of my patients are of Mexican descent, like myself, and I think we come from a great sort of center of food. You know, we have a lot of great foods in our diet,
mm-hmm.
and some kind of snuck up on me, like Bertolagas, which is purslane. You know, Mexicans have been pulling this as a weed from pastures for forever and making a great dish with it, and little did I know that it's great for your heart. You know, it's the highest plant source of omega-3 fatty acids. So I'm a physician. I'm a mom of three kids who I have somehow convinced that fast food is not a good thing, so they expect me to cook.
How old are they?
They're 25, 19, and 17.
Well, Laura, you are living in a place where local foods are available with some variety around the year.
Yes.
But what do you see as being the trickiest part of this project, of eating local for 12 months?
I think it's just what I find in my cooking is just a little more planning and being a little more creative. And I think just finding out more about what's available locally. Like I just found out, for example, that somebody I went to high school with raises, you know, local chickens for eggs and for eating.
Hmm.
And also, you know, I've sort of ventured into growing more vegetables myself. I grew some purslane this year and some tomatoes and some lettuce, and I'm going to try to do more this year.
Don't you love it when you find yourself planting what part of the world sees as weeds?
Yeah.
When I started growing dandelions, my husband, he lost it for a very short period of time. Laura, thanks for talking with us, and we'll be talking online as well.
Okay, great.
Okay.
All right.
You take care, and thanks for joining the project.
Oh, it's great talking to you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Laura Solario is one of the 15 people from across the country taking part in our Locavore Nation project. I guarantee this is going to be an intriguing thing to track. Check out our blogs on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the connection between Napoleon's nephew and margarine? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed to last for years to come. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in the home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the connection between Napoleon's nephew and margarine? Well, Napoleon's nephew, Napoleon III, ruled France in the middle of the 1800s. He offered a prize to anyone who could create a substitute for butter. In 1869, chemist Hippolyte Méga-Maurice took the award. He figured out how to turn beef fat into a spread that could, yes, taste just like butter. He called it oleomargarine. The British food magazine Waitrose Food Illustrated included this event in its 10 least glorious moments in food history list. Now, I can't find any records from 1869 to tell us what the French thought of that taste.
I have a feeling some of it might not have been printable. And by the way, one of the other 10 least glorious moments in the history of food, according to the Waitrose magazine, is in 1937 when Hormel's Spiced Ham held a competition for a new name. Spam won. 6 billion cans sold so far.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
It's time for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have got Mickey calling from Duluth. Mickey, what do you want to talk about?
I would love to talk about ice cream.
Ah.
I've been making homemade ice cream now for a couple of years. We got a stand mixer attachment type thing. So I'm into doing like making the batter and cooling it and that sort of thing. But I feel kind of stuck with the recipes that were given to me in the instruction manual.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's got to be some holy grail ice cream recipe book or something out there that I can go to, because I feel like I can make really awesome ice cream, but I'm kind of, my hands are tied, because I see the ones in the stores that are like ice cream and just by generic authors and stuff, and I feel like maybe it's good, maybe it's not.
Yeah.
But that's why I'm turning to you.
And boy, oh boy, I've just drawn a complete blank. There was a book that came out on ice cream. It's a paperback format, but it's about maybe 11 inches wide. And I want to say the author is Bruce Weinstein. I could swear the first name is Bruce. This came out a couple of years ago. And this person has done books on desserts and whatever. And I know that the testing is very scrupulous.
Okay.
So that would be, you know, one place to begin. I think another thing I would do is go to Epicurious online, because that's Gourmet Magazine and Bon Appetit. And both of them test to a fare thee well.
Okay.
But the other thing that you can do is create your own flavorings.
You know, I'm down with that.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, you've got – I mean, I remember at one point we interviewed Ben and Jerry.
Okay.
And one of the things that they talked about is how they would create flavors. And they said essentially what they used was a formula of milk and sugar, or, you know, milk, cream, and sugar – instead of doing the cook custard base you're doing, which, by the way, you can do this with a cook custard base or not. But then what they would do is they would add a flavoring until it was really intense before they would freeze it and put it in the machine.
Okay.
And they would put it in the machine and they'd see what happened. It's just that simple, because the worst thing that will happen is you may get ice cream that doesn't totally freeze.
Right.
Because you added something that's too much liquid or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you can do, I mean, I a long time ago I taught ice cream making, and I'll be, I mean, I haven't made ice cream in longer than I can want to remember. But let me tell you one of the things I remember coming up with that I was exceedingly proud of, unduly proud of.
All right.
I love coffee ice cream.
Yeah,
and
I'm down.
Yeah, and one of the things that I did was I did essentially a basic, the custard, whatever you're doing, right?
Okay. Yeah.
With vanilla. I had made a really, really strong dark roast coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So I added that instead of some of the milk, okay?
Okay.
And then the other thing I had done was I had taken sugar and water in a skillet, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And I had essentially made that into a caramel. You cook it until it gets to be an amber color. You immediately pull it off the heat.
Okay.
And I had stirred into that cracked dark roast coffee beans and let it cool. I added a little water, just a little water,
mm-hmm.
so it didn't get solid. And then what I did is I warmed it up and I strained it. It was like making a tea.
Okay.
You follow what I'm saying? I let it sit.
Yeah.
I strained it, and then what I did was I added that to the ice cream machine sort of just before the ice cream came out, so it would be, you know, like a thread of this coffee-flavored caramel in there.
Right.
And just as, you know, toward the end of when the machine's working, pour that into it, because you'll just get like a lacing of it through it.
Like a nice coffee swirl.
Right. Now, the other thing is, basic sort of ice cream flavoring 101, which you probably already know, is that when you warm the liquid, you know, when you make the custard.
Yep.
With the eggs and the milk. You could warm that milk ahead of time, or cream, and use it just like tea. In so many words, you could add lavender flowers to it.
Okay.
You could add Sichuan peppercorns and orange to it. You could add stuff like, you know, ancho chili and something sweet. But you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let that sit in the warm milk for about 20 minutes and then strain it. You could do ginger and cinnamon and strain it. You see, so the idea is you intensely flavor that liquid, and that becomes a big part of the flavoring.
Right.
You know what would be great to try? I've never done it, but I just think it would be fascinating, is tamarind.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, just
I like
a little.
The sound of that.
Yeah, or add the tamarind, because it's so thick, the way you would that caramel toward the end of the ice cream being mixed, so it gets just a thread of it going through. It would be fabulous.
Ooh, yeah.
So does that give you what you think you can go
that's
out?
That's fantastic. Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, you can really just go to town on this. And as I said, the worst thing that happens is sometimes if you add something that's too liquid, it may freeze and become a different consistency.
And I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
Soft serve or hard serve.
Yeah, exactly. I love the way you think. Yes, exactly. So go forth and make dynamite ice cream.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Hey, you take care. If I hear of an ice cream shop opening up in Duluth, I'll know what happened.
Oh, we'd love it.
Thanks, Mickey. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Call us 800-537-5252. We have Irene calling from Boca Raton. Irene, what do you want to talk about?
Yes, hi, Lynn. First of all, let me say what a pleasure it is to really speak to you personally today. I just love your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, just your generous and joyous approach to food and glorious dining. I mean, you feel you're there when you're basically you're describing instances and recipes. I had a question. We were in Volterra, Italy, a lovely small town I'm sure you're familiar with, this past May. And very close to our hotel was a fabulous old cafe that we used to frequent in the evenings for a coffee and cognac. And they had this amazing chocolate panforte that was, it weighed an absolute ton, or we would have brought
a whole
rondelle home. I was wondering if you have a good recipe for a chocolate one, or if you know of a U.S. source online where if I run out of time to make it, I could order one?
Well, one source that comes to mind is Gustiamo.com, Gustiamo. Just make sure, tell them you want to make, I mean, you can mail order, and I think they may have chocolate panforte as well. They definitely must have the other one. They must have the chocolate. Chocolate's become so popular. Tell them you want to make sure it's from this year, because people hold it from year to year.
Oh,
you know, it's
really?
Yeah, like fruitcake, but it does sometimes get a little stale.
Yeah.
And for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about, panforte means strong bread, and it originated in Tuscany, in southern Tuscany, in the town of Siena. And it's a mixture of candied and dried fruits and spices. It's and there's figs. And there's always nuts in it. And it's kind of held together with a bit of flour. But you, as you know, you eat it in very thin wedges. And you chew. And it's just, it's delicious.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Yeah. Now, I'm just trying to think. There's a wonderful new Italian dessert book out. And I think it's actually called Dolce Italiano.
Okay.
But I can tell you the name of the author. It's Gina Di Palma. Gina is the pastry cook at Babbo, you know, Mario Batali's restaurant in New York.
Right.
And I could swear she has a recipe for panforte. Oh, and if she does, it is really with panforte, because it's not a risen cake or whatever. It's sometimes as simple as adding good quality melted chocolate to the mix.
Right, like a lint or something.
Yes. Yeah. Maybe you want it.
Really difficult to make. I mean, I'm an excellent cook, but not the world's greatest baker. Is it very difficult?
It's
thing
not
to make?
Difficult. It's a very forgiving recipe.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Just a lot of chopping and, you know, stirring and whatever.
Right, right.
But it's not a hard thing at all. Again, the great gift of panforte is it's like making a mud pie.
Right.
You're not making anything that's risen,
that
you know, if you beat it too much, it's going to be ruined and that kind of thing. And I would say it's certainly worth a shot. You know what's fun to do? If you have friends that are like-minded,
bring a couple of people together for an afternoon, a Saturday afternoon or Sunday afternoon, and make a whole batch.
That's
and they make great gifts. They make wonderful gifts.
Terrific.
Okay?
Really love your show.
Thank you for the kind words.
Thank you, Lynn.
You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Now, remember, you can reach us any time of day, 800-537-5252. James Velas is the Southern Gentleman of the food world. For 27 years, he was food and wine editor of Town & Country magazine. His cookbooks and articles keep winning awards. But in his latest book, James has taken on one of those guilty pleasure foods. The book is The Bacon Cookbook. James, welcome.
Good to be here, Lynn.
James, when you talk about bacon, all bacon isn't alike. So,
no, it isn't.
Are there distinctive methods in making bacon? I mean, is there like a collection that you should understand?
You mean in producing bacon or in cooking bacon?
In producing the bacon.
Sure they are. I mean, and one reason I did the book is because for the first time in about 80 years, we've got these wonderful artisanal producers all over the country now turning out, you know, really handmade bacon. Mm. I mean, some of the most glorious bacon in the world. Some people call it old world bacon. I'm not denigrating all supermarket bacon. There's some pretty awful bacon out there. There's also some very good bacon. There are different cures. There's a wet cure. There's a dry cure. There are millions of ways of smoking bacon. These premium producers, these small producers, you know, they really are going head over heel, you know, in doing it right. In other words, in the right kind of cure, the length that they will age bacon, you know, smoke bacon, the number of hours that a bacon needs to be smoked. There are many, many, many technical, highly technical ways of producing bacon.
So generally speaking, though, you'd have a wet cure where the meat is immersed in a brine and a dry cure where the piece of it's a belly, right? It's a bacon usually comes.
Most bacon is belly. I mean, you can start getting up to the loin when you get into Canadian bacon, English bacon, Danish bacon.
Uh-huh.
As you know, you can get part of a loin, and then you've got a tail of fat. But most bacon is made, you know, from the in the area of the belly.
Mm-hmm. So a dry cure is where the salt and the whatever other seasonings is rubbed into
right,
that
bacon. Right,
and
that's the finest cure, and that's also the rarest cure.
Why is it so rare? Is it just a lot
because
more...
Because it's time-consuming.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very time-consuming, Lynn. And also, dry cure, you know, you're talking about wasted space. Now, I'm not denigrating, again, all wet cures, because some of the artisanal bakers do use a wet cure. If a wet cure is done properly, but again, you don't want to get into all that because it's highly technical. But all supermarket bacon, believe me, is a wet cure. You won't find any dry cured bacon in the supermarket.
Yeah, and so often in the beginning of the ingredients list, which means in the largest amount of something, the word water shows up. So you're paying for a lot of water.
Well, not only are you paying for a lot of water, but that's the way to tell the difference when you're cooking bacon, let's say in a skillet, is if you start getting that milky-looking stuff, that watery stuff, you know you've got a cheap bacon there. But you put an artisanal, it'll shrink terribly, you know. But you put a premium bacon in there. I just did this morning, as a matter of fact. A good premium bacon in a skillet, it holds its form. It does not exude any, well, virtually no liquid except its own fat. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a beautiful product.
Oh, I know it is. It's so good. All right, we're in the market, and we're looking at bacon. Is there anything that we can see that's going to tell us that we're dealing with a really high quality?
I think so, Lynn, and I get in trouble all the time. You're talking about in a commercial market, right?
Yeah. Or
in a supermarket.
Yeah, yeah.
First of all, I'm looking for the right ratio of fat to lean. And if I see something is just pure fat, I throw it out. I won't even look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But above all, even before I do that, I look at the color of the fat. If that fat is the least bit yellow, then I discard it.
Okay.
You want a really creamy white fat on your bacon. But again, you need enough lean in there to give you that chewy quality. But just, on the other hand, you need enough fat, sweet fat, to give it that wonderful flavor of bacon.
So about a half and half spread?
It's like a Manhattan drink. I like mine about half and half. Now, some people are different, you know, but that's what I prefer.
So if you find a bacon that has a farmer's name on it or has a smokehouse's name on it, it's generally going to be worth a try.
Oh, sure. You'll pay more for it, but it's worth it. And also, fortunately, many of these premium bacons are now showing up in the supermarkets. You'll find Schaller and Weber, which is one of my very favorites. You'll find Nodine's. You'll find Nyman Ranch in California. Newski's in Wisconsin. Mm. I'm seeing that more and more. And I had a pleasant shock the other day. In one supermarket, I saw some real English bacon, which is my favorite bacon in the world.
Well, James, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
James Velas is author of The Bacon Cookbook. Now, to push the envelope a tad, James left us with a dessert recipe. You can get the recipe for bacon and peanut butter chocolate truffles on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this little poem from Ogden Nash. He wrote, "The pig, if I am not mistaken, gives us ham, pork, and bacon. Let others think his heart is big. I think it's stupid of the pig." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room and Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Information on nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. And just in case you missed us one week, you'll find free podcasts of our entire program at that very same website, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. And special thanks this week to Chris Hegel. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.